I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday. Our subject today is science, the nation's commitment to it, and the nation's understanding of it. In the second hour, science educator and writer John Monahan joins us again to talk about science literacy, or the troubling lack of it among Americans. Up front, we speak with the president of Johns Hopkins University, Ronald Daniels. Just last week, he and the dean of the Hopkins School of Medicine wrote in the Wall Street Journal about the troubling lack of federal commitment to research generally, and particularly to that being conducted by the next generation of American scientists. Our conversation with the president of Johns Hopkins starts after the news from NPR. Everyone, once again, welcome to Midday. Dan Rodericks with you every Monday through Friday from noon to 2 on WIPR Baltimore, WIPF Frederick in Hagerstown, WIPO Ocean City in the Eastern Shore of Maryland, and streaming live online through WIPR.org. We thank you again for making Midday part of your day. President Obama's proposed budget for fiscal year 2015 prompted negative reactions from the American science community, as congressional caps on discretionary spending have kept the amount of money dedicated to research relatively low. The Association of American Universities, an agency comprised of 62 research institutions, including the Johns Hopkins University, claims that the modest increases in President Obama's budget does little to close the nation's innovation deficit. Last week, Johns Hopkins University President Ronald Daniels contended in an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal that the innovation deficit stems from a lack of funding to younger scientists in particular, those under the age of 35. It's younger scientists with riskier, out-of-the-box type ideas who often make the innovations that are needed. That was a piece co-written by President Daniels with Paul Rothman, the CEO of Johns Hopkins Medicine. Today on our show, President Daniels is here to talk about that, the funding problems, and also what Johns Hopkins has been doing in the community of East Baltimore in particular. We'll talk to them about the doors opening last fall for the Henderson Hopkins School in East Baltimore, the first such venture by the Johns Hopkins University into university-assisted community school partnerships. So we'll be hearing about that in this hour of the show. We welcome back to the show Ronald Daniels, the president of Johns Hopkins University. It's nice to see you again, sir.
Great to be here.
Let's start with the op-ed, because this is something I wrote about myself in my column in The Sun last fall. The specific problem with, you know, scientific research funding in general, but specifically for young scientists. So let's talk about that a little bit for you. Folks might wonder, well, young scientists, they have a lot of work to do before they get funding from the National Institutes of Health. What does he mean young scientists need funding?
So let's start off. And, you know, the article that we just wrote focused on this issue of young scientists, in particular, the rather startling reduction in support for young scientists in the United States today. About 35 years ago, about 5.6% of the total NIH funding, National Institute of Health, of course, provides about $30 billion a year in scientific research support. About 35 years ago, about 5.6% of the funding goes to young scientists, that is to say, scientists that are 35 years and younger. Today, we're looking at about 1.3%. And that reduction, of course, has really very significant effects on the capacity to rejuvenate the quality of science, the character of science that is done in this country. You often look to young scientists as the people who are going to bring novel, bracing, irreverent approaches to science that ultimately result in the kinds of breakthroughs that change the nature of scientific inquiry. It's not that young scientists have a monopoly on new or bracing ideas. It's just that we know over time that great breakthroughs are associated with young people coming into a field and rejuvenating it.
And these breakthroughs take a lot of time. So the need here is to create a career track, really, for research scientists, right? Because if you don't get to them early, if they don't believe that they can have a career in it, they look elsewhere.
And that's what we're starting to see happen. You know, that the period of time from undergraduate to graduate education to postdoctoral work, this is a very long period of time, requires a significant amount of investment by individuals in their careers. But if they're looking out and seeing at the end of that road, the investment by the country and the kind of science they want to do and the impact that they can have, if that's not there for them, then they start thinking about alternative opportunities. And so this is a really serious issue for the country. And in some sense, it's just another marker for the costs that we are suffering, where over the last decade, we have seen a 20% reduction in the level of real funding going to NIH research funding in the United States. And so, you know, the irony for me and for others who are charged with leading institutions in the United States today that focus on research and education, you know, precisely at a time when we are recognizing the benefits of the innovation economy and knowing how significant the social gains are, the social benefits from investment in research and education, we as a country are scaling back. And the fact is that other countries around the world are seeing the great success of this model of scientific funding that has been pioneered in the United States. They're emulating it. They're investing at levels that we are not right now.
China's one of them.
China's one of them.
Where else do you see it?
You see it in Western Europe. You see it in the Scandinavian countries. You know, the success of the Great American Research University in partnership with the federal government is known around the world. And what's really striking to me is when I travel in Asia, in Europe, throughout the world, in fact, countries understand that in an innovation economy, the key is to invest in research and innovation, and they're doing it and doing it at a level that is really breathtaking at precisely the time when we're standing still in real terms or, in fact, declining.
In this country, some people hear you and say, yeah, I agree, but why the government? Why is it government funding? We're in this age of austerity in government. We're also in an age of sort of anti-science, too. We're going to talk about that in the second hour of our show today. You have these sentiments out there that are brewing that are leading to this or contributing to it, wouldn't you say?
So I think there are a number of factors that explain this, and I think there is a lot of short-termism that explains our failure to think about our responsibilities here. But again, what's really striking is if you look at the economy we're in and the benefits that are generated by technology and what this means for communities that are successful in planting these kinds of innovative activities, again, doing so in partnership with universities, there are very substantial benefits. And this means not just good jobs for the people in the innovation clusters, but in fact for people surrounding those clusters in service industries, complementary industries, and so forth. This past weekend, I had a chance to read a book that's been sitting on my shelf for a few months now by Enrico Moretti on the new geography of jobs. And the argument that he makes that is really very powerful is that for every job that is created in an innovation industry, there is a multiplier effect that five other jobs are created in surrounding industries. So again, this isn't just about the innovation cluster. It's the jobs, it's the benefits that bleed out to people and to communities around those industries.
What are you seeing at Hopkins then? Just a smaller pie, fewer grants to request, to apply for? Is that how it's playing out?
So we're seeing all of these things. I mean, it's not surprising that we have very established, brilliant, creative researchers in the middle of their career and finding that when they go back now to secure funding for the next big project, that funding is not there. And it's not that they're not getting good reviews on their competitive grant applications. It's just simply that the funding is not there in the institutes in the way that it has been in the past. So, this is not just a young person problem.
The young person problem creates a gap in the generations, doesn't it?
Exactly.
The passage of knowledge from one generation to another, the continuity of research across decades.
You know, what I like to think about is this as being not just about a group of individuals who for a period of time are going to suffer while they're waiting for the funding to come back on stream. What in fact we're really talking about is a lost generation of science, that these people, as they look rationally at their career opportunities and saying, this this level of funding that we need to flourish is not going to be there. So we think about other careers and other avenues. And that has very serious effects on the scientific engine that has bestowed so much bounty on this country.
Johns Hopkins University President Ronald Daniels, our guest in this hour of midday. You're welcome to call with a question at 410-662-8780. Toll-free long distance for the midday show is 866-661-9309. Remind me, President Daniels, it's Peter Agri or Agri?
Agri.
Agri, A-G-R-E, one of the Johns Hopkins Nobel laureates. He won the Nobel for Chemistry in 2003. When I talked to him last fall, it was during the government shutdown. He was also referring to the results of the sequester on funding through the National Institutes of Health and said this. He says, it is easy to cite the work of highly successful scientists like James Rothman and Randy Shekman. They were the Nobel winners this past fall in physics, as reasons for not interrupting NIH support due to government shutdowns. But a more important issue is the degree of difficulty faced by young scientists seeking their first independent support. It concerns me greatly that young scientists with the potential to win future Nobels will give up ambitions and talent in science to seek safer careers to support their families. Are you seeing that at Hopkins? I mean, are you seeing fewer medical students interested in research?
We're seeing this. We're seeing this at Hopkins. But when you get together with my peer institutions, with the leadership of those institutions, they're seeing the same patterns in their institutions as well. That is a growing sense of malaise and uncertainty about the level of support that will be there for this generation if they want to commit themselves wholeheartedly to science. And it's this science that, again, is the engine that drives this great country.
You have some ideas that you put forward in the opinion piece that ran in the Wall Street Journal last week, how to reverse the graying of scientific research. So aside from just give us more money, what are your ideas?
Well, I wouldn't gloss over the give us more money. Well, and no, again, I would say it's give the country more money.
Yeah.
But yes, that's an important restoring the level of NIH funding
that's
to
the main
its historic.
That's
essentially the piece of the puzzle. That without that, I think you're really on the margins. At the same time, we've thought about ways in which you could try and have more targeted investment on young people. The NIH has done a lot of this in their funding programs. They're acutely sensitive to this issue. I think there's more that can be done there. There may be some creative ways in which you can think about the grant review process so that when young investigators are applying for their first independent research award, there is an openness to the possibilities of the kind of science that that those young investigators, when they're taking really novel approaches, how they might get treated in that process. And we've also thought about ways in which we can encourage senior investigators who have been well-funded by the NIH to start thinking about how they can take on a responsibility for mentorship and transition to the next generation. So again, this is a complex ecosystem, but we're going to have to take a look at a number of these issues in order to be able to address the problem.
I wonder why it's a problem. I mentioned before it's the age of austerity, but the argument that if you plant some seeds, if research leads to development, leads to innovation in the development of other economies, other business, really, for a community like Baltimore, for instance, where the research is based, that is a better model than the one that Republicans in particular argue about, which is, you know, government funding of general programs, general welfare programs.
I think it's so important to continually talk to all parties and the members of the parties about the fact that we have a responsibility to maintain the strength of this country, and that the support for R&D in this country is lifeblood for the stability, the economic performance of the country. And that's an issue. That investment issue, to my mind, transcends party politics. We all have a stake in seeing the survival of the country and seeing America continue to lead in this globalized, innovation-oriented economy. This is this country's birthright.
You say in your article, and you mentioned this on the air, South Korea, Sweden, Israel, all pulling ahead of the U.S. in terms of what percentage of research money for based on GDP?
Percentage of GDP devoted to research.
Yeah.
And so we're now finding that not only has the United States declined in terms of the level of GDP devoted to research, but at the same time, again, countries are not standing still. They've seen the success of this model, and they're increasing their overall spending as a level of GDP, both from public and private sources. So this is worrisome for us.
We're going to continue our conversation with Ronald Daniels, president of Johns Hopkins University, in this hour of midday. You're welcome to give us a call with a comment or question, 410-662-8780. Back on Midday, Dan Rodericks here with Ronald Daniels, president of the Johns Hopkins University. 410-662-8780 is our number here. Who do you take this argument to Congress, by the way, for more funding through NIH? Do you personally or your associations?
Yes and yes. So that, you know, that we're just simply unrelenting in the case that we make. And so we, you know, we're on the Hill. We're doing it. We're doing various advocacy pieces. We're working with a number of leaders from industry and other sectors, again, you know, trying to remind the country of the importance of this investment for a number of different reasons.
We have a number of comments on the president's budget in the last week or so, talking about basically it's a flat line when you look at when you take into account inflation, very small increases in R&D, money going to the National Science Foundation, the National Institutes of Health, and the Department of Energy's Office of Science. It's pretty much a flat line, according to most reports.
It's our view is it's even worse than that. You're still seeing year over year real declines in the level of research funding in the country. So even after, you know, the effort by the administration to put some money into the research envelope, inflation eats away at that. And so we're seeing, again, contraction in the level of support. And this translates directly into the effect that you're seeing fewer awards, smaller awards, and, you know, much greater competition for that limited amount of support.
Ronald Daniels, the president of Johns Hopkins University, is with us for the remainder of this hour. If you have a question for him, please give us a ring. You can also send us an email to midday@wypr.org. Last time you were here, we started talking about Johns Hopkins' work on the east side in East Baltimore, not far from the hospital. And in this past fall, I think that a new school finally opened there, the one that we had talked about, a new community school over in the East Baltimore development area, the EBDI area, as it's known. Henderson Hopkins School in East Baltimore finally opened. It's operating.
It is. Been open for several years, but in temporary quarters. But the key move was this past January, we actually moved to a new facility, a $53 million.
That's what I meant. It's a new
place.
Yeah,
a $53 million facility.
Wow.
For a kindergarten to grade 8 program. And there's about 370 students there now. We'll go to about 450-60 next year, and we're also starting an early childhood education program. And this is the first school to have been built in East Baltimore in about 20-25 years. And significantly, it's a school that is being operated by the School of Education at Johns Hopkins. And so we're all in on this school and feeling very excited about it.
I heard that the Dean of Education of Hopkins actually lives near the school or in the neighborhood?
He lives about two blocks from the two, three blocks from the school. When he came to Hopkins, he really is an all-in guy. And Dave Andrews is passionate about the school, passionate about his commitment to urban education. And not only was he really excited about setting up this new school and being able to take a lot of curriculum innovations that have been developed at the School of Education at Hopkins into the school, but he wanted to live in the neighborhood and have a very tangible statement of his commitment to the rejuvenation of East Baltimore. So we're really fortunate.
Well, I want to see this new facility. I'm sorry, I haven't seen it yet. The kids were in there. How many kids were going to that school that was over there that this one replaces?
So in the temporary quarters, again, we had about 360-70 kids.
So, so pretty much the same size.
So we moved them over, but now we have the capacity to grow, and we will grow to an excess of about 600 students at the school.
So tell our listeners, please, why Hopkins got involved here.
So for a number of different reasons, you know, the East Baltimore Development Initiative is, as I've mentioned before, the largest urban rejuvenation project taking place in the United States today. It's an 88-acre project just north of the health campus in East Baltimore. And that project contemplates a physical rejuvenation of those 88 acres and building commercial, residential, life science space, a new park. There's a number of components to the kind of community that we are working to establish there. But critically, and this is something that we felt very strongly about at Hopkins, we thought it was important that among the contributions that Hopkins would make to this project would be to work with the community and to build a very strong school in the neighborhood. And it was always understood that there would be a new school in East Baltimore, but what was not well understood was, or even accepted at the start, was that Hopkins would be the operator of that school. And there was a really strong sense within the university that this is a way in which we could make our commitment to the community very tangible and direct. And so we worked with the community, and ultimately they were open to the idea that Hopkins would be the operator of the school. And we have not just simply brought in a dean who in turn has recruited a great principal to the school, who is committed to this the success of the school. But we have essentially used our fundraising engine to bring resources to bear to the new school. Hopkins itself will contribute or has contributed $15 million in the cost of the capital construction of the school. So this is something that we're very committed to. Indeed, so many different parts of the Hopkins community are going to be making contributions to the operations of the school. Our Peabody Institute of Music actually has two dedicated music studios that they will be doing music training right in the school facility. We have our lacrosse team is doing after-school instruction for students at the school. We have tutoring going on by some of our undergraduate students in math and sciences. So again, we see this as a very important place in which Hopkins can make its commitment to the community real and have, we hope, a significant effect on the quality of the experience of the kids who are there.
The Henderson-Hopkins School operates under a contract with the city school system, is that right?
That's right.
So how do students get into the school? Are there any can anyone attend who lives in the area? How is that done?
So basically, anyone who lives within the 88 acres that is EBDI, they get first run at the school. So if the people in the neighborhood want to attend that school, they get the first choice. And then as you work down, there are a series of priorities for people who are not within the living within the catchment area to get access to the school. And so our hope is that as more housing comes into the acreage in EBDI, this will just be a school for that community. And what we're trying to do is provide the most powerful incentives possible to get people to live, work within that neighborhood and make it a strong mixed-income neighborhood.
Our guest in this hour of Midday again, Ronald Daniels, president of the Johns Hopkins University. Can you scope out how things are going generally in EBDI? I haven't been there actually for few months now. I got to get over there and see what's going on. There was concern that, you know, with the recession, the housing redevelopment had slowed down. There was also a concern that people who had lived in that area previously before the renewal effort had moved out and then wanted to live there again someday, but there was no housing affordable for them. So on those two things, could you just sort of give us the landscape over there in EBDI?
So there's no question that the recession, the Great Recession over the last several years, really set back the program. But having said that, if you are over in EBDI today, you'll take a look, you'll see cranes in the air. And slowly but surely, the redevelopment project is taking shape and form. So for instance, the Department of Health and Mental Hygiene is doing a major building there, which will be open in the next year, and that will bring 500 new bodies to East Baltimore. That's the state. Hopkins, during the recession, built a graduate student, supported the creation of a graduate student apartment building. Again, another way to get boots on the ground, because we feel it's very important, obviously, to have people living, working within the area. We're about to start this summer an 8-acre park right in the center of EBDI, which will again be a focal point for life in the project. Walgreens moved into EBDI, the first major national retailer to move into East Baltimore, into this neighborhood in a very long period of time, opened up a flagship store there. So slowly but surely, not on the schedule we would like, but the development is starting to take shape. And we're hoping this summer to have two different residential construction projects launched that will allow market buyers to come in and purchase homes in the district. So there'll be
housing at different levels of affordability.
Exactly. Right now, the housing that is there that has been built has been essentially below market for low-income residents. We're hoping now that the next tranche of housing that comes in is for middle-income purchasers. And the price point that we have in mind is at about the $210,000, $220,000 level. And it's our hope that we'll have market buyers who will say, look, when you look at the amenities, you look at the access that you get to the school, given that, again, it is the people who are going to live in that community who will have the first priority to get into the school. We hope that we have a proposition here that will replenish and rejuvenate this great neighborhood.
That's great. Right. And you said there's pre-K being offered now or will be offered?
In September, we're going to open up the Early Childhood Education Program, which the Weinberg Foundation invested about $10 million in creating.
You know, having a quality school really as a sort of centerpiece of that neighborhood, that's going to drive everything else.
That's the bet.
Well, jobs obviously at Hopkins drives part of this. But having a school there, and the idea of Hopkins employees maybe living there, actually raising a family nearby.
That's
what we want in Baltimore.
That's right. The hope that we're going to get a good mixed-income community, and the school, we believe, is the linchpin for that.
410-662-8780 is our phone number here for Midday. If you'd like to ask a question of Ronald Daniels, the president of Johns Hopkins University, while he's with us, you can also send an email to midday@wypr.org or tweet us on MiddayWYPR. Our conversation continues in just a moment, but first, a quick break as we try to raise the money it takes to bring you the news and talk programming you hear here on WYPR. For that, call 410-235-235. 1395. This is an email from Frank in Hampstead, Maryland, on the subject of funding of scientific research and development that we've been speaking with Ron Daniels about, the president of Johns Hopkins University. Frank says, I believe that part of the problem with lack of science funding is the tearing down of science by politicians, news organizations, and other private parties when that science is at odds with their ideology and political goals. How do you contend with organized undercutting of science for ideological goals?
So I think this is our challenge in higher education and those people who are associated with this new innovation economy, that we constantly have to bring facts to bear in this argument. And the facts that are very clear, and that is that these investments in research translate immediately to new drugs, to new therapies, to new products and services that change our lives for the better. And so, you know, although this does at times get wrapped up in broader ideological challenges, you know, the fact is that the record manifests very clearly the benefit that comes from investment in science. And as I said before, this is widely recognized around the world. And when other countries are inspired to adopt these changes to their own government spending patterns, they're very much looking at the United States and the historic success that this country's enjoyed. I should say, you know, for me, one of the more encouraging features of my experience as university leader is to see the extent to which there is a growing awareness, I would say, across the party divide of the importance of funding research, and particularly NIH funding. You know, again, it doesn't matter where you are on the political spectrum. People,
why the reticence then? Why are we even talking about it? Why is this still a problem?
Well, I think this is bound up with larger issues about the level and nature of the government in our society. And I think there is a There's spillover effects from that debate on the research and investment debate. And so I think that for a lot of people, these two get inextricably linked.
I can understand a conservative arguing that the EPA should go away or the Food and Drug Administration, too much regulation and all. But when you talk about the National Institutes of Health, I would think that that's where you draw the line. This is research that could lead to a healthier nation, a healthier world.
And increasingly, they do draw the line at that issue. So there is a recognition of the importance of this funding stream.
Are you being an optimist? Is this wishful thinking?
You have to be.
Before we move on, I wanted to ask you about another area of investment by Johns Hopkins. We mentioned the East Baltimore investment, the big undertaking over there, including with a school, the Henderson Hopkins School. What about around the Homewood campus? And some folks may wonder, if I'm talking about the streets being redesigned there up on Charles Street, that's actually a city project.
So I'm not
that Hopkins is involved in, right?
That Hopkins is right now, like everyone else, looking forward to that construction project being completed on Charles Street. So
I'm talking about the neighborhoods nearby.
So about a year and a half ago, we announced yet another initiative, which really is an approach that is different in kind to what we're doing in EBDI. But here, we have spent a fair amount of time consulting with the 10 neighborhoods around the Homewood campus. And again, very much part and parcel of this view that Hopkins is of the community and is anxious to engage the community and build strength together in areas of shared interest. And after an extensive period of consultation and a report that was prepared by Joe McNeely, we agreed to make a $10 million investment over 5 years that would be devoted to projects in those 10 neighborhoods around the Homewood campus. And so, for instance, this past year, we invested close to $1 million in projects at the Barclay and Margaret Brent schools in order to make some improvements to their premises, to open up their lunchrooms to sunlight, to improve the restrooms in the schools. But this was in the best spirit of partnership. We were fortunate to have investments from the school board as well, and we're able to see significant matching funds come into play. We're hoping that over a 5-year period, this funding stream will be matched by a number of different sources and government, foundational, and so on, and hoping that in the end we can put about $60 million into the neighborhoods around us and focus on retail development, on dealing with vacancy issues, blighted projects, and again, true to what we've done in East Baltimore, focus on education and making our local schools even stronger. So again, we can imagine that more people associated with Hopkins and people who are not associated with Hopkins will want to live and work in these communities.
Ron Daniels, another item that caught my eye from the News Hub at Johns Hopkins University has to do with academic freedom, an announcement from you and the provost, Robert Lieberman, I think just a few weeks ago, I think in February, announcing that you're putting together a group to develop language that articulates the university's philosophy and principles on academic freedom. Johns Hopkins has been around for 130-plus years, so some people may wonder, why are they just getting around to that now? What brought this on, and what is the aim here?
So I think very simply, the idea is to have a clear and concise, I hope, statement of the university's commitment to academic freedom. To my mind, and I know this is shared by a number of other leaders at Hopkins, academic freedom is absolutely the core of the great research university. And what's interesting is, despite the very important role that the university has played at times in its history in supporting the ideal of academic freedom, a record, I should say, though, that is not perfect or unblemished, but by and large, we have at very important moments in our history been firmly committed to this value. Despite that, we did not have or do not have a clear statement of it and an overarching policy framework that properly supports this ideal. And we thought that we're not in the midst of any particular controversy or issue right now. This is a good time in the best traditions of the Academy to stand back, take a look at the issue, get colleagues from across the institution to advise us, and hopefully come up with a formulation that will properly anchor this commitment going forward.
There must have been something that precipitated it. People point to the Matthew Green incident in September. This is the associate professor or professor in engineering who was blogging about the National Security Agency and was, asked to stop for one day or something like that.
So I think it was in the context of that and other incidents that when faculty, in fact, wanted to cite the university's commitment to academic freedom, they had to look to other sources. And they know there's an oral tradition and a commitment to this value at Hopkins. That's not in doubt. I think what
Around the time of the Matthew Green episode?
It was around that time, and I think more generally the conversation has been there a few times over the last couple of years that I've been at Hopkins. This is now my fifth year, that people have said, you know, this is an important value. Why don't we have, as other institutions do, a clear and unequivocal statement that commits to the central value of academic freedom, and this is why we're doing it. We think it's important we don't rely on others, that we have our own statement of our commitment at Hopkins. So that's the enterprise.
Hopkins seems to be always growing. This is an assumption that people in Maryland and Baltimore make, is that the Hopkins seems to be growing all the time. You drive over near you call it the health campus, the hospital. It all seems to be sprawling and growing. Of course, Homewood physically seems to be limited in terms of how it grows physically. But where is the university growing? I guess someone living in Baltimore may wonder about that. Where do we see growth in the university?
So I think that, you know, question can be thought about in a number of different ways. I think in terms of the size of our schools and programs, we're in steady state. So we're not looking to increase our student body in any of our programs. I think that's capped now. But I think there are areas where we are anxious to provide a stronger support for students and faculty in various parts of the university. So, for instance, this past year, we opened up the undergraduate teaching labs. This is a new building on the Homewood campus that allowed us to develop new lab space to support a very innovative set of changes that we're making to our undergraduate science curriculum. And so that's, you know, one area where it's driven by a sense of academic priorities to provide the strongest possible science undergraduate education, and that meant a new building. Similarly, on the Homewood campus, we're just on the cusp of doing some significant construction in the Charles Village area, where we're looking to build a new student apartment building that will not only house upper year students, but also bring some new retail activity into Charles Village, and doing that in close concert with the local community there. Hmm. So that's another area where we see growth. And the East Baltimore campus, the next big project that we're hoping to do relates to this innovation agenda, and that is that we're anticipating the construction of a building in the EBDI footprint that will focus on supporting innovation and have an incubation facility in it, so that this is a place where students and faculty and others can congregate and develop startup companies and so forth to take advantage of a lot of the research activity that is sponsored at Hopkins.
Hopkins has made a push on R&D and innovation. Could you talk about that a little bit more?
Sure. You know, this past year, Hopkins received about $1 billion in federal research funding. That's ignoring the applied physics lab. So just the university in the absence of APL. And of that amount, we received about $18 million in licensing revenue that essentially is based on ideas, research ideas that have been funded by the federal government that were then translated into industry. There is a strong sense at the university that we want to improve that record, and that this is important for our faculty and students who are interested in taking their ideas and getting them out into the marketplace, of ensuring that a very promising research discovery about a new pathway, a new target, in managing some disease actually finds its way to a pharma company and to a product. And so we see this as important in terms of the desire of faculty to have impact on the world, but also, quite frankly, this is very important in terms of the job creation that can come to Baltimore if we are effective in ensuring that the ideas that are hatched in Baltimore at Hopkins stay in the city.
Excellent. Ron Daniels, thank you for being here today. I hope to have a visit with you once in a while. It's good to catch up with you and find out what's going on at Hopkins. I'm particularly interested in the Henderson-Hopkins School, so maybe we can make a trip there one afternoon.
We'd love to host you.
All right. Thank you very much. Ronald Daniels is the president of Johns Hopkins University. He's been our guest in this hour of midday. Now, the article that I mentioned, the op-ed that appeared in the Wall Street Journal last week, written with Paul Rothman, the CEO of the Johns Hopkins Medicine and Dean of the School of Medicine. You can find a link to it on the Dan Roderick's Facebook page if you'd like to read it, and you can post some additional comments there. We're going to take a break for lunch, finishing up our first hour here. I want to thank Atwaters for providing lunch for our guests today and our staff. Atwaters supports local radio, local farmers, and local appetites. Located locally at Belvedere Square, the shops at Kenilworth, Bear Hills, or Main Street, Catonsville, visit atwaters.biz for more information. So we got another hour ahead for you folks, so please stay tuned. Midday on Science as we continue our conversations today about science in the United States. John Monahan will be joining us as usual for Midday on Science in the second hour of our show.